Awesome. I'm so pleased with what the Lord's doing here and how He's raising up people to do things. A year ago, we didn't have a team ministry, and now we have a team ministry. At least it was very small. And I think last Sunday night I was here. Thank you, brother. Breaking those chains. And last Sunday night I was here, and I think there were 20 kids in the team group. And it's quite exciting to see what God's doing. Make sure you support them. Will you do that? Let's give them a hand again. Great job. Good job. Now, all those who work with the teens, would you stand up? Sarah in the back, Dave in the back, Missy, Shauna, who else is here? Thank you for doing all that hard work. If you've ever done youth work, you know how much work that is. That's a lot of work. And I appreciate those people very much. Well, guess what the theme today is? Dealing with addictions. And that's why they did that skit and sang that song. So I figured we better bring the heavy hitters out for that one. So we have a guest speaker this morning. His name is Donnie Capper. And I think you know him. He's a municipal judge here in the county. And he's coming this morning, and he's going to bring a message today about addictions because he has a lot of experience with people who have addictions. I thought you'd... But we're glad he's here. Ronnie Hayes, we're glad you came too. And Donnie, if you'll just come on up, we're going to have you speak this morning. Now, Donnie is a favorite son of Beulah, and he was raised in this church. And his parents were in this church, so he's very important to us. And he's going to deliver a message this morning. There is a biographical sketch in your bulletin about Don, if you don't know him well. And we're glad he's here this morning.
Thank you very
Welcome,
much.
Welcome, brother.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's quite an honor to be here. I'm sure the folks in my BYF 50-some years ago would probably be really surprised that I was being invited back as a guest speaker. But it is an honor. My first memories that I have are of this church right across the street. The nursery was upstairs in the old building, and there was four boys born within a 3-month time. Johnny Arnold, Keith Zimmerman, Bruce Wimps, and I were all born and raised in that church. And, you know, when you're a kid, you don't appreciate how good you have it. You know, I was surrounded by really good folks, and my parents were very good folks and Christian and lived it every day. In fact, Ron James spoke to me this morning and said that my mom was his Sunday school teacher, and I remember those days. My mom had the youth, and my mom didn't brook anything from anybody, least of all my brother and I. She put down the rules, and we had to follow them. And that's the way it was back then. I guess I'm getting to be an old guy because I think about things the way they used to be. Yeah, I was saved at Beulah. Reverend Hill was the pastor then, and I got baptized in March over at the river at the lock. So you think about how it's a little different time when you take a 9-year-old and stick him in the river and baptize him. It was just a little chilly at that time, but that's the way it was done then. And I'm glad for the upbringing that I had. Wonderful people. And thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I want to talk about something today that I think most of you know is going on, but perhaps you don't know to the extent that we're facing it. And I've had a ringside seat to it, unfortunately. I've been the municipal court judge there in Chesapeake since 1990. I was appointed initially when Charlie Byrd was the previous judge. He was killed in a car wreck that year, and then I was appointed by the governor. Then it is an elected position, and I was elected thereafter. And that position covers this half of the county. It's more than just Chesapeake. From the Ashland Bridge to Crown City out to Waterloo, that's the geographical jurisdiction, about 40,000 people, so it's 2/3 of the county. Most of our population now is in the eastern end of the county, so 2/3 of the population is in my court. And when I first became judge, you know, the main thing that people think about courts and the that gets a lot of the attention is the criminal cases. And in the municipal court, you have the misdemeanor. So that's not where people are going to go to prison, but drunk driving, domestic violence, assault, those kind of things are the kind of cases that I deal with and have dealt with over the years. And when I first went on the bench, 85% of those problems were young men and alcohol. The combination of those two things, I would say, was most of our cases. And that has changed drastically over the years. So that now, most of the cases I deal with involve drugs. Alcohol's still there. It's just that there's so many more cases now involving drugs, because when I first went on the bench, and for years and years, we didn't have drugs in this community. Very little. Some marijuana. Never had heroin. Never had methamphetamine or fentanyl. And now those things are very common. So I want to talk to you today about what's commonly called the opioid crisis. I think you've probably all heard that term. And it's very real. Opioids are drugs that are derived from the poppy. It's like morphine is the original drug that was derived from the poppy. And it's a painkiller, but also can bring a euphoric sense to people if they take it. And there's a lot of other derivatives. Oxycontin was one that came along after a while. And to give a scriptural context of this, I want to talk about Mark. You know, in Mark 5:13, it talks about you are the salt of the earth. We Christians are the salt of the earth, and I take that to mean we're to have an influence. You know, salt, when you put it in food, you taste the salt. You don't have to put a lot of salt in for it to come to the fore, and you taste that. We as Christians need to influence the world that we're in. And we need, I think that's what the Lord's talking about, says when we are to be the salt of the world and of the earth. And we need to have our influence and make our influence known. So to understand this opioid, and I don't know if I'm going to hit the right button, you bear with me and see if it's going to go here or not. Apparently not. Oh, okay, there we are. I'm not here to sell any books, but I think, I believe strongly that knowledge is power. If you have a problem, you need to know as much about the problem as you can. And there is a book out that I read, and I highly recommend it to you. If you want to know about the opioid crisis in our country, and not only just in our country, but here in our community, and I have a copy of it here with me. It's called Dreamland. It's by a fellow by the name of San Quinones. And I actually got to meet Mr. Quinones about a month ago, a little more than a month ago, at the annual judicial conference. They have a conference every year where all the judges in the state of Ohio attend in Columbus, and he was one of the main speakers. And he wrote this book, and it really traces the history of the drug crisis that we have in this country. And our community and our area of the country is like the epicenter of this. At this conference, he told us that how he got interested in this and in writing this book. He'd written other books before, but he was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and he had no connection to this area of the country. And he saw an article that talked about 9 heroin deaths in Huntington, West Virginia within a short period of time, and they didn't understand where it was coming from. And it intrigued him, so he picked up the phone and called the Huntington Police Department. And he was able to get through to the chief and talk to him about it. And the chief said, "We don't really know what's going on. We've had a little bit of heroin in this city, but not like..." And we're talking back in 2009, 2008, somewhere around then. But this is all the blue. We've had these 9 deaths in a short period of time. So this got Mr. Quinones interested in what is going on here. And he started doing the research for this book. And I highly recommend it to you, because you will see how we played such a role. And it's here, folks. It's here in our community. And it started, to trace the history of it, started, and I'll just give you a very brief history. It came out of Mexico. Mr. Quinones had some connections in Mexico. He'd actually lived there for 10 years. There's an area in Mexico called Jalisco. And Nayarit is a little town there. And heroin is like their way of making a living. It's very poor. They make black tar heroin. And one of the things that they came on an innovation, if you want to look at it that way, like a business model, they started delivering pizza, heroin-like pizza, so that if you wanted a dose of heroin, they would bring it to you, a single dose, and it didn't cost very much. And if you didn't pay them, unlike prior drug dealers, they weren't going to break your kneecaps or shoot you or kill you. They just wouldn't deliver you anymore until you paid them. And they targeted the rural areas of this country. And one of the reasons they did that is because it's not very violent. Try to go to Detroit and sell some heroin. See what would happen. Your folks would wind up, your people you're having deliver are going to have a war on their hands with the other drug dealers. They could come to rural America, sell their heroin, and not face those kind of consequences. So we had that, and then prior to, we were set up for this so much too. Oxycontin, hydrocodone, Percocet, all the opiate drugs. We went through a phase in this country, and our area again got hit very hard by those, where the pharmaceutical companies were telling doctors through their representatives, you can prescribe these drugs and they're not addictive. And that was based on one very small study that turned out to be not very scientifically correct method in doing the study, but that's what they sold doctors for years and years. And therefore, if you remember, Portsmouth, Ohio became the largest pill mill area in the United States for a period of time. There was a Dr. Proctor that went to federal prison for selling drugs there. He was like the lead. People remember his name. And that's where the book Dreamland comes from. I mean, if you grew up here like I did, there was a Dreamland pool in Catlettsburg, still there. There was also a Dreamland pool in Portsmouth. And it was like the center of the community. And one of the things Mr. Quinones talks about is how growing up in the 50s and 60s, and even in the 70s, in these towns along the river here, there was work. There was more hope. There was more economic vitality. A young man, because that's usually who worked back when I was a kid, could grow up. When I was in school, if you wanted to go to work at AC&F or Owens or someplace like that, you can make a pretty good living, provide for your family with a high school education. And those days are over. And with that came some despair and hopelessness, and that made it ripe for the problem that we're now facing. So the pill mills played a role that actually happened before the heroin came in. A lot of people got addicted to pain medication. And in my experience as a judge, I told you when I first went on the bench, young males and alcohol were the primary problem. And I would say that was true up until around 2000, late 90s, maybe 2000. Then I started to see people with pills. And that was with the oxys and so forth, and people were getting those off the street. And when that happened, it wasn't just the young males anymore. It was females also. Okay. And when we started seeing females, you know, our caseload went up. And then we started seeing opiate overdoses from pills. And I wanted to put this statistic up so you could see this. It's from the Center for Disease Control. And it shows you the number of opiate deaths by year. You can see how it's increased. From 2002, there was 22,000 people in the United States that died from overdoses. In 2017, that's the last year I could find a statistic, it was more than three times as much. So I started seeing in the court young females with pills and young males with pills plus the alcohol situation. And a lot of times it was tied into theft. You know, we have a Walmart in the jurisdiction of the court. A lot of shoplifting. A lot of people shoplifting to support their habit. And I would get folks into court that way. And we also start seeing people overdosing, even on the pills. In 2016, just to give you some point of reference, there was roughly 4,000 overdose deaths in Ohio just from drugs. Okay, as soon as I pick it up, it's going down. And I want to give you a perspective on this, and one of the reasons I add this number here is because I find it interesting as to what we can do when we put our mind to something and work at it. The year I picked that, you can go back and look up the number of automobile crash deaths for every year. So I just did this by every 10 years, and I was born in 1955. So in that year, there was 165 million people who lived in the United States, about half of what the population is now. And there was 37,000 deaths. In 2015, it was actually less than that. There's twice as many people who live in the United States now as there was in 1955. And we actually had less automobile deaths. And I'm going to guess, I think I'm safe in this, that people travel more now than they did in 1955. So I'd say there's a lot more miles, a lot more people out on the highways, but still the number of deaths are less than they were in 1955. And why is that? Because we saw what the problem was, and we attacked the problem. You know, when I was a kid growing up, there were no seat belts, there was no bags in cars. Cars are a lot safer now. We looked at the problem and said, what can we do about this? And we addressed the problem, and we've made a big difference. So I think we can do that with the overdose. Okay. Just for another perspective, in 2016, there was only 1,100, I mean, that's a lot, but 1,100 people died from automobile crashes in Ohio. I'm going to have to look this up because I can't read it from back here. So bear with me while I look up Matthew 25. Matthew 25 is from the Sermon on the Mount. Starting, if you're reading along, Matthew 25, 42. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me. And they also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you? He will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. I don't know if you're advancing or if you would advance it or if I can advance it to the next. Okay. I want to tell the story because I think this illustrates so much in our own community. And some of you probably know this young lady, or at least know her mother. Sorry to get emotional, but it's still very emotional for me. This young lady's name is Megan. And she was in my court this last February of 2018. And she'd been there before, three years before. And it was a fairly, I guess you would call, minor offense. Offenses are ranked in Ohio by their classification. A fourth degree misdemeanor is the lowest level misdemeanor that's jailable. That's the maximum penalty is 30 days in jail and $250 fine. And she was charged with domestic violence against her brother. She'd threatened her brother, but she hadn't actually done anything to fulfill the threat, but she had threatened him. And she pled guilty to that, was sentenced to a suspended jail sentence. And let me also say, 3 years ago, there was no indication of drug involvement then. I mean, she might have been involved with drugs, but it wasn't a part of the case. Nothing came up about that. She was supposed to do some community service and pay a fine. And the way I do things in my court, I have review hearings. So if you're ordered to do something, you will come back before me and I'm going to review. Did you do it or not do it? And you're going to be in trouble if you didn't do it. Or if you don't show up for your hearing. Everybody gets a warrant that doesn't show up for their hearing. Megan didn't show up for a hearing. She had a hearing about 6 months out after her sentence where she would have had to appear. She didn't appear. So a warrant was issued for her arrest. Well, on a fourth degree misdemeanor warrant, they don't go track you down, come to your house and drag you out. They're going to wait till the next police contact, and it's going to, if you get stopped for speeding or whatever, run the ID of this person, it's going to show they got a warrant. Then instead of getting a ticket, you're going to go to the jail. And that's what happened to Megan. In February of 2018, I had court, and here comes Megan out in an orange jumpsuit and shackles. And, Megan, what's been going on with you? Why didn't you do anything? Looks like you didn't come to your hearing. You haven't done anything you were ordered to do. Well, she said, I moved out of Proctorville. She grew up in Proctorville. I've been living in Markham Terrace. I don't need to explain that here. Everybody knows Markham Terrace. She says, I'm on heroin now. I'm pregnant. And I've been diagnosed as being bipolar since the last time I was in court. So there. What are you going to do with that one, Judge? Fortunately, or she was willing to go to treatment, and we do have some options now. When I first started dealing with these drug issues in our county, we had almost no options locally. We had to beg and plead to get folks into treatment in Cincinnati or Dayton, but there was nothing local. Now we do have local options, and I sent her to a place I think is doing wonderful work. It's called Mended Reeds. And they can do addiction counseling, and they can also do mental health counseling. So they started working with Megan, and Megan did very well. And she still will come back. She went to treatment. And look, I only had 20 days over her head. She could have just said, Judge, I'll take my 20 days. There would have been nothing I could have done. But I knew she needed to go to treatment, and I wanted her to go to treatment, and she agreed to go to treatment. So she went to inpatient treatment. That means she's living there at the facility, and they're treating her every day. And she became a leader. She was helping the other folks, and she's in a house with other all women. She's helping the other women that have problems. At this time, Megan's 34 years old, pregnant, and she has other children. That's one of her children that's in the picture. The baby was delivered August 22nd of this year, and Megan finished her inpatient treatment right before then and went to live back here in Proctorville with her mother and other children. And then sometime in October, I got a message that Megan didn't make it. And she would still come. She was going to outpatient treatment and still coming back for review hearings, and I was supposed to see her on November the 2nd, which is going to be her birthday. So when sometimes I think people believe or start to think that this can't happen in my family or can't happen to people that I know. I had a connection with Megan, you see. I coached her in basketball. Megan is the second from the left in the first row. And Elaine's in the back row. There are so many people that are facing this, and I'm sure all of you know families that this has been affected by. What is our responsibility? One of the things I was thinking about is, and I mentioned what a great job I think my parents did and the other folks that were at Buell when I was growing up. A lot of the men were the World War II generation. And they seemed like men to me as a kid. There was no question, they were the men and I was a boy. They gave a lot of leadership. This church has been here for nearly 200 years. And it was their turn. I think they did a good job, but they weren't facing the problems that we're facing. It's our turn now. In 50 years, what are folks going to look back on and say, well, Buell Baptist Church in 2018, 20, 25, what were they doing? What was our community doing for that? I heard there was a drug epidemic. I hope they'll say, I heard there was a drug epidemic back then. I'm sure glad we got through that and passed that problem. But we're in the midst of it right now, folks. And I'm not sure. I want to be positive, but I invite all of you to come to my court Mondays and Fridays. A lot of times people ask me, is it open to the public? Yes, it's open to the public. That's one of the main tenets of our legal system. There's very few exceptions. Juvenile cases, a few cases are closed hearings, but for the most part, it's all public. So you can see what's going on. And that's important, to be transparent. Come in and sit and watch. You might have trouble getting a seat. We kind of have to run people in and out in shifts. We have review hearings first. Those folks leave. Then the arraignments. That's the new cases. Then the pretrials. Then the trials. If you've ever been by there on Monday or Friday, you'll see. A lot of times cars parked up and down the highway because they can't all get in the parking lot. And you'll see what our community is dealing with. My estimate is I have 10 to 12 new cases where drugs are at the root of things every week, at least that many. And talk to Ron James, he'll tell you, from my understanding, I got this from folks both at Children's Services and Cabell Huntington Hospital, 25% of the babies that are in the neonatal care unit Cabell there have been drug exposed, born drug exposed, are from Lawrence County, Ohio. I know a lot of times people want to think, well, that drug problem's over there in Huntington. No, folks, it's right here. It's right here, too. I want to turn to Mark 12:29-31, because I want to talk about what our response should be as Christians. And this is in Mark. This is the shortest gospel. I think the one that they believe was written first. A learned person came to Jesus and asked, of all the commandments, which is the most important? And he says, the most important one, answered Jesus, is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. The second is this: love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. And then, to boil it down even more succinctly, in 1 John 3:23 says, "And this is his command, to believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and to love one another as he commanded us." Faith and love. To boil it down to two words: believe and love. That's what we're commanded to do. And what is love? What constitutes the kind of love that we need here in this situation I've been talking about? Because I see that too as a problem. You know, I love ice cream. You can ask Ronnie, if there's ice cream around, I'm going to eat it. And I love chocolate. I could eat a hot fudge sundae every day of my life. Probably one every meal. If it was there, somebody brought it out, I wouldn't say no. But should I? If you have a child, you know, if you give your child ice cream, I've got a grandson who's like me, Jackson. He loves ice cream. He'd eat it every meal. Is making someone happy, is that showing that you love them? We have to be focused on the long term. I think love is action that helps someone in the long term, not in the short term. And I see with families so much enabling, because they want to make somebody happy today. But making them happy today may be their downfall in the future. So, I've got these a little bit out of order. Maybe I can come back to it. Okay. All right. One of the things that I think we need to do, one of the things I proposed, and Rob is going to help me with this, I believe, I'd like to see us as a community have a faith-based recovery support. There is so much work to be done, folks. You know, I have a lot of, just guilt about Megan, because I thought Megan was doing so well. And, you know, she had her baby, and I mean, she even posted something on Facebook saying, "I'm not sleeping very much." And I had a picture of the baby. And I said, "Well, hang in there, it'll get better with time." And now looking back on it, that seems like a pretty inadequate response to what she must have been going through. Megan's mom has now 4 children that she's raising, from a freshman in high school to an infant. We need to support the families in our community. We need to support people that are in recovery, that have addiction issues. As a church, isn't that what love is? Isn't that showing love? There's so much of an opportunity here. I have people in jail right now that didn't go home for Thanksgiving because they relapsed. And I know there are people that maybe disagree with this, but the consequences are so serious. I'm thinking of 2 right now. They're sitting in jail as we speak. And one had done so well. But there has to be consequences for failure, and there has to be support for people who do well. Those folks, I'm going to try to get back into treatment again. But though I won't name their names, even though it's public record, you could go look it up. But one of them, if you go look on my Facebook, I've got a picture of me holding his little boy because I saw him at an event and he brought him up and wanted me to have a picture with him. I've got a picture of me holding his little boy. And after that, he went back and started using methamphetamine again. I said, Jeffrey, what are you doing? Why would you do this to your son? And he lost, I'm sure Ron probably knows the case, he lost his rights, at least temporarily, to see his son. I don't have all the answers, but I got a lot of the questions. And I believe as a community, this is going to overwhelm us, folks, if we don't get a handle on it. Right now, I have in my court, I see so many young adults who are totally just checked out. And the grandparents or grandparent is raising the children. And the frightening thing is, this is, I don't have statistics to back this up, but this is my observation, is that when I started seeing the drugs come in, it was typically 30 and under. Then it got to be 35 and under. And now I'm seeing people in their 40s that I have in front of me. What happens when we have two generations? Who's going to take care of the kids then? What's going to happen to our schools when we have all these kids that either were drug exposed in the womb or were raised in addicted households? We have to face this problem now. So I think as the church, as followers of Christ, we have to show love to the addicted, to help them recover. But that's a hard task, folks. I mean, not hard to love them, but hard to get them out of their addiction. The other thing we have to do is a lot more for prevention. And I applaud you. I see the kids out here playing soccer. I think we have to have those kind of activities. We have to have things for kids to do. And what Mike said was so true. We have to start at such a young age. If you wait till junior high, their attitudes are already formed. They already know what they already think by the seventh grade, maybe earlier. They already think they know more than you do, and they probably do on some things. So you got to start earlier in the primary grades. And we have to make it so that it's not attractive to them, that they don't feel like this is something they need to do. Two other stories, and then I'm going to wrap this up. If you go look on my Facebook page, I shared the story of this young man in Arizona, 18 years old, star quarterback on his football team, 6'4", 210, blonde, good-looking kid, good student, overdosed and died. And what was the story? Not just him, but one of his friends. They went to a party, and somebody had a pill that said on the outside Percocet that was laced with fentanyl. They both took it, and the next morning, go in, they're both dead. And this other story is from my own experience. A young lady that I put into treatment at Spectrum, which is one of the agencies that we have now that does inpatient treatment in South Point. And I went out to visit the facility to look it over, and she was there. And I talked to her, and she was 21, and I put her into treatment there, inpatient treatment. And I said, tell me your story. How did it come that a 21-year-old is hooked on heroin? And she said, when I was 14, I went to a sleepover. So, kids, listen to this. This is how you can fall into this. 14, I went to a sleepover. Up to that time, I'd never even tasted alcohol. I'd never sampled a beer, anything. Nothing. Never tasted it. But one of my friends brought some pills. They said they got out of the medicine cabinet at home that were OxyContins and said, I've heard it's a lot of fun to crush these up and snort them. And she said, I did it that night, and I went from there to 7 years later, I was addicted to heroin. So just by accidental meaning, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, being around the wrong people, and just saying the wrong answer once can result in disastrous consequences. So we have to face up to this. We have to face what the problems are and meet them head on. And I want to see the church more involved. There's a great opportunity to do it. It's a mission field, folks. The fields are white into harvest. There's people there begging that need help. And I want to close with Hebrews. This has become my favorite verse recently. I'll have to find it again because I can't. That's a little bigger. Maybe I can read it from here. Hebrews 12, 1 and 2. Therefore, seeing how we are encompassed about by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off every weight that hinders us and the sin that so easily entangles us, and let us run with perseverance the race that is before us, that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is now set down at the right hand of the Father. This battle against the opioid crisis, addiction issues, is not going to be a sprint, folks. It's not going to be over in a year. It's not going to be over in 6 months or 2 years. We have to gird ourselves and run this race with perseverance because it didn't happen overnight. It's not going to go away overnight. And we need you. Our community needs you. We need this church. We need all of us to be involved, to fight it, to make a difference. So there won't be another Megan. The picture that I showed you, the team picture I keep on my desk at the court now, and that, I had it at home when I brought it in. I didn't tell you that story, but I brought the picture in because I had it at home, and when Megan had a review hearing, I said, I had the bailiff show it to her, and she said, "Can I get a copy of that?" And I said, "When you finish your treatment, I'll give you a copy." So when she finished her inpatient treatment and went home, I had a copy framed and gave it to her. And I let my guard down. So now I'm keeping that picture on my desk to remind me to work more diligently, to run the race with more perseverance, so there won't be another Megan. Thank you for allowing me to come and speak to you. Pastor, would you come?
Thank you. Well, I think we heard a lot of wisdom in the last half hour. And one of the profound things that I heard was, we have, as parents, we have a belief that is wrong. And the belief is, if I can make my kid happy, my kid will think that I love them. That is a false belief. I ask many parents, you know, what's your goal for your child? You know how many parents tell me, "I just want them to be happy." You need to rethink that, parents. The definition of love we heard this morning, it was a very good definition of love. Love is giving. Love is not just letting anything happen, hoping that everybody will like me. I can earn their favor by letting them do whatever they want. Parents, your kids really need you badly. And you can't shuffle this off to the school. We can't do that. We can't shuffle it off to the school. School has a role to play. Everyone in our community has a role to play. But parents, it's on you. And God holds you responsible, and I'm praying for you. Because if you have the wisdom that you heard this morning, and you take that wisdom to heart, and you practice that, you may save your kids. How many of you here have someone in your family, or someone close to you, that has a drug problem? Look at that. That's probably a pretty good representation of what it's really like. My nephew has been Narcan'd half a dozen times. He died 3 times. This past summer, he mowed the grass out here because I just wanted to keep him busy. He gave his time, did weed eating and so forth, just so I can do my little bit to try to keep him out of trouble. But you know, all of you have experienced this pain. You know what it's like. We need to hold one another up and pray for one another. But parents, we got to do a better job as parents. We have to. We can't just make our kids happy all the time, get them involved in all kinds of stuff, and think that that's love. That's not love. We've got to take care of our kids. Now I'm going to ask you, as we dismiss, if you want me to pray for you and your children, I'm going to invite you to come right here. Especially if you have grade school and down, those are the people that I'm thinking about this morning. Let's stand together. I'm going to end the service this morning with prayer. And if you want me to pray with you and your children, you can bring your children with you if you want, or you can come. But I want to pray for parents who say, I want you to pray for me. I want this church to be a part of the solution. Lord, I pray right now that you will work in the hearts of people who might need help. Help us to realize that it's not other people's problems. Thank you for the message that Don brought us today. And we know from the scripture in the book of Romans that Don is a minister of God. And we pray, Father, that you will bless him and his work. And bless all of our teachers and administrators here. And bless all the law enforcement people that are here. And all the people who are trying to deal with this problem, Lord, help us to work together. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. If you want me to pray with you, come on up right now. Everybody else is dismissed. Thank you for coming today.